And hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Andy Bomick, which means once again it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I've been reading now for about 6 weeks, titled Angus, Thongs, and Full Frontal Snogging, Confessions of Georgia Nicholson. All right, but first let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Dream for the Land. And then it's Falling Water, the building of Frank Lloyd Wright's masterpiece. Then Mr. Katz and Me, Lunch from Home, and if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with The First Day of Peace. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled Dream for the Land. At dawn, Pa lines up our boots by the door. He smiles and musses my hair. Then his eyes narrow. Do you hear that? I hold my breath and listen to the world wake. Coffee bubbling in the pot, the gentle knocking of the clay planters hanging from the front porch, and then a faint rustling, a stray squeak. The bunnies are trying to eat our vegetables for breakfast, Pa says. I shove on my boots and chase after them. Critters, big and small, scatter from the rows of squash and tomatoes and potatoes. Shoo, shoo! I must the leaves the same way Pa must my hair. Some fall dry and thin. The tomatoes look withered on the vine. This is the second batch that hasn't made it. I nudge a plant with my foot, and a horned toad skitters across the soil. I wave a hand, shooing it away, too. Pa crouches. He's not hurting anyone. Then he scoops it up, the horned toad's bulbous belly resting in his palm. These little guys eat insects, not vegetables. Here. Pa holds the toad out to me. Give him a scratch. I rub the horned toad right between his eyes, and they slowly close. He likes it, I say. You know what else they like? Pa asks. Then he brings the toad to his lips and kisses it on the head. Ooh, I squeal. When I look back at Ma, she's laughing between sips of her coffee. Then you make a wish. Pa lowers the horned toad back to the ground and let them go. The horned toad scurries away, disappearing into the scraggly tomato vines. What did you wish for? I ask. Pa gives me a tired smile. I used up all my wishes a long time ago. That kind of magic is only for the young. As the sky lightens, I see the lines on Pa's face. Lines that have gotten deeper lately. Speaking of magic, Pa says, it's time for you to sprinkle some of yours. We spend the morning tending to the earth, pruning and pulling weeds. Poor squash, Ma falls to her knees. Pa sighs, spider mites. This drought is making them worse. We planted the seeds months ago. Then we waited, hoping for roots to take hold, for tiny fingers to grip the soil, holding on for dear life as they sprouted into this wild world. This is the land that great-grandpa tilled with his burrow, that his mother and her mother tilled by hand. Land that used to be as green as jewels, fed by a cobalt river, Pa swam in when he was a boy. But the river's gone, those winding curves that used to hug the earth, burrowing into Pa's skin instead. Pa lifts his head stares at the sky. They'll make it over that ridge, Ma says, hoping. But the clouds are shy again today, clinging to the hillside, refusing to roll toward us and burst open over our small farm. At last, Pa looks down, trying to hide the tear that falls from his eye. It sizzles against the soil, not quenching anything. And I know that Ma's hope is not enough. What we need is magic. I take careful steps, searching every shadow and bushel of green. I find sticks and snails and half-eaten carrots, crickets and rocks and cracked pecan shells. I search high and low, up and down, in and out. And then I see it, another horned toad, resting in the shade of Ma's rose bush. Even though I'm afraid of getting stuck, I reach my hand into the thorns. Pa, I run to him. Pa, I caught one. He smiles at Ma. Hey, maybe you're right about our luck changing. I hold the horned toad up like a prize, and then I say, I'm going to wish for rain. Pa kneels in front of me. This time, he doesn't hide his tears. You're not going to use your wish on yourself, Mita, he says. In that moment, I think about great-grandpa. I think about his mother and her mother, too. About every member of our family who has called this place home. About all of the people I'll never meet who will also call it home. Isn't rain what you would wish for, Pa? I ask. If you could? Pa faces the rows and rows of turned soil and the blazing sun beyond them. He squeezes me close. If I could, I would wish to change the hearts of the men who ran these rivers dry. I would wish for them to stop thinking about their own dreams and start thinking about yours instead. I stare into the horned toad's eyes. What if there's no time to wait? I plant a gentle kiss on his head and dream for the land and the world as it once was. I dream for the world as it could be. Falling Water, the building of Frank Lloyd Wright's masterpiece. Once upon a time, Frank Lloyd Wright was the most famous architect in the world. But by 1934, he was just old. Someone even said he was dead. He wasn't, but it had been years since he had built anything newsworthy. A stream in Pennsylvania was about to change all that. Flowing fast and cold, tumbling over dark rocks, between rugged hills, rushes a stream called Bear Run. In the office of his Pittsburgh department store, Edgar Kaufman thinks of building a new house. Factory smoke whirls outside his window. Streetcars noisily clangs fill the air. He writes a letter. Dear Mr. Wright, I have a project in mind for you. Please come for a visit. Welcome to Pittsburgh, Mr. Kaufman says. But let's hurry. It's Bear Run. I really want you to see. Wright hears the thunder of a waterfall and sees rocks stepping up a hillside, sees water rushing over ledges into pools below. Campfires have been built on that big rock for hundreds of years, Kaufman says, and Wright sees that firelit rock as the heart of a house. For a long time, Frank Lloyd Wright has dreamed of building a house by a waterfall. Now he will have a chance. A week later, he writes to Kaufman for maps showing every rock, tree, and says, "Visit to the waterfall in the woods stays with me, and a dwelling for you has taken shape in my mind." In the spring and summer, right comes to bear run, to look again and again at the land and how the water falls. The slopes are steep. He will have to build up. He imagines a tower. From it and the rocky cliff, the house must grow. Back in Wisconsin, Wright puts on his hat, takes up his cane, and walks the countryside. But he has not seen Wisconsin. He has seen the falling waters of Bear Run. In dreaming this house, he will use everything he has ever seen. Stone walls from Wisconsin, sand and adobe from the Southwest, towers and trellises from Italy, art prints from Japan. And he wants to hear the waterfall in every room of the house and to see sunlight fill every space. In his workroom, Wright studies the maps, notes the stream, the falls, each rock and tree. But he does not put pencil to paper, not yet. Instead, he dreams. It has been 9 months since Wright first saw Bear Run. Mr. Kaufman calls. He is in Wisconsin. He is coming to visit. He wants to see the plans. He will arrive in 2 hours. He is coming to see his new house. Wright's assistants worry. There are no plans, and plans take months. But Wright is ready. His dreams have made him ready. He sees every boulder, tree, and waterfall. He sees the house that will live among them. His assistants are ready too. Big sheets of paper, ready. Then, pencils flash. Wright talks slowly to himself. Erase, erase. Paper crumples, flies. Pencils break. Resharpen. Lines cross, crisscross, connect. Shapes appear. A house like no other. Magic. A house like no other. Where sun can shine. Where balconies fly. Where falling water is heard from every room. Wright finishes with a flourish. Mr. Kaufman knocks at the door. Our house on the waterfall. Yes. Kaufman opens the quarry opened, and within months, men with crowbars and mallets begin to dig and haul sandstone for this house like no other. Pry and dig and lift, stone upon stone upon stone. Choose and fit and stack, stone upon stone upon stone. Workmen load rocks onto carts. Others trim stones, chip them for walls growing higher. Walls like the hills own stony ledges. Sand, cement, gravel, mix, mix, pour. Now concrete wings and long flat roofs step up the hillside. In the thundering water, scaffolding spreads its spindly legs. Like branches extending from a tree, the house stretches out over the falls. Rock, concrete, glass, stone, tower, 3 stories tall, metal, the red of an old Indian pot. The scaffolding is knocked away, and the dream flies free, soars over the water. Never has there been such a house. In December, the Kaufmans move in. At their holiday parties, pine branches fill the house with the smells of the forest. Like a lantern glowing in the trees, the house hangs in the darkness. Wright visits in the spring. In the early morning, before anyone is awake, he explores the house he has named Falling Water. He sees the living room, just as he dreamed it, dark and low as a bear cave. He listens, and through the many windows comes the music of water, the tune always different, always the same. The trees, the stream, the waterfalls are still there, and this house looking like it grew right out of the rocks. Belonging. The flagstone floor, like wet rocks in a stream. The large boulder jutting beside the fireplace. The heart of the house, just as he imagined on his very first visit. Out on a terrace, the moist air swirls around him. He leans over as far as he dares. Dreams. And the house that flew still flies. Over waters, under skies. And somewhere, someone dreams, so can I. So can I. Mr. Katz and Me. Some nights after dinner, kids come to our house to learn how to sing with my father. If they agree, my father lets me sit in the den to listen. Some sing high, some sing low, some sing like canaries, others like crows. One evening, a tall, wrinkled man with an accent came to our house for bar mitzvah lessons too. How can you have a bar mitzvah? I ask. You're way past 13. Sarah, my father frowned, and I felt embarrassed for being rude. After all, the man was trying to learn something new. The old man smiled. Such is life, madlif. What is a madlif? Well, it's what we call a little girl in Yiddish. I'm not so little. I'm in second grade. You're right. He held out his hand. Sal Katz, a pleasure. His fingers trembled in mine. Most of my father's students are nervous at the beginning. I thought Mr. Katz might be nervous too, but he said he would be honored if I listened, and so I could tell that he wasn't. He was very polite. When he read a B sound instead of a V sound, and my father corrected him, Mr. Katz said, "Thank you." Every time my father corrected him, he said the same thing, "Thank you." Mr. Katz saw me staring at him and winked, like we shared a secret. I hardly knew him, so I didn't wink back. At break time, I helped my mother serve a snack. As I handed him his cup, Mr. Katz dropped it. Hot tea splashed on my feet. "Oh, no," I cried angrily, "my new shoes." "Forgive me," said Mr. Katz, "my hands have grown clumsy." "You drop things too," my mother told me. I realized she was right and that I should be more patient. The next time Mr. Katz came to our house, I was at the front window teaching myself how to draw a blue jay. "Will you sit with us again?" he asked. "I'm pretty busy," I told him, which wasn't really true. "I understand," he winked. "I love birds." "You're a Katz who loves birds?" I asked. "Exactly," he said, and we both smiled. When he opened his briefcase, it was empty. "Did you forget your book?" I asked. "Yes," Mr. Katz replied, "but I did remember to come." That made me laugh. He laughed too. It felt good to laugh together, and I decided that I wasn't too busy to sit with him after all. Dad loaned Mr. Katz a Hebrew reader. It was the same one I had. "How old are you?" I asked. "I am 81 years young," Mr. Katz replied. "I'm 8, I said, "and we have the same reading book?" He nodded. "A wonderful coincidence, eh, Madlif?" Mr. Katz's memory was as shaky as his hands, but he was a good student. After a few weeks, he could read better than me. It made me want to study harder. When he chanted, his voice sounded as sweet as a canary, only deeper. I sounded like a duck. I wished I could sing like him. One night, I asked Mr. Katz why he never had a bar mitzvah. "Because in Russia, where I was born, having a bar mitzvah was dangerous," he said. "Such things were forbidden. The government closed our synagogues, and our Hebrew schools. They made fun of our names and how we looked. We had to hide who we were. "Were you afraid?" I asked. "Sometimes," he said quietly. "I would have been scared all the time," I said. "Mostly, I was angry," he said. "So that's why you came here?" I asked gently. "Yes, to be free." "It wasn't fair of them to treat us like we didn't belong," he explained. "When I first arrived in this country, I thought it was too late to have a bar mitzvah. Then I met your tadla." "My father?" "Yes." I smiled at him. "I'm glad you met him." Mr. Katz smiled back. "I am glad that you are glad, Sarilang." The night of his last lesson, I hummed along quietly. After he was done, Mr. Katz hugged my father. He kissed my hand, and we hugged too. At his bar mitzvah, when his voice echoed across our synagogue sanctuary, it gave me goosebumps. I was proud to be his friend. Even though he has already had his bar mitzvah, Mr. Katz keeps coming to our house once a week for tea and cookies. But he doesn't sing with my father. He sings with me. When I chant at my bat mitzvah, I want to sound like a canary too. Lunch from home. On Monday, everyone had a sandwich for lunch. Well, almost everyone. Preddy brought soft doka cake, topped with fried spices called vegar, and a side of bright mango pickles. "Yum, my favorite," Preddy said, opening their lunchbox and smiling. But the kid next to them said, "Yuck, that's your favorite? It smells stinky." "No, it doesn't," Pretty said, smile fading. "It smells like my kitchen." That night, however, they asked their mother to pack a sandwich for lunch tomorrow instead. The next day, a kid at Minna's table wrinkled his nose at her gimbap and said, "Ooh, you're eating seaweed." Minna looked at the neat, green-edged rolls of rice with carrot, radish, and ham at their center. "It's not seaweed," said Minna. "It's gim." "Looks like seaweed to me," said the kid. So on Wednesday, Minna brought a sandwich too. And when Nikki unpacked her everything bagel with its layers of lox, cream cheese, capers, and tomato, the kid next to her said, "Cheese and fish? Are you actually going to eat that?" "Yeah," said Nikki. "My dad says it's a classic." "No," said the kid, "it's just weird." When she got home, Nikki told her dad she wanted regular sandwiches for lunch from now on. On Thursday, Ray was the only kid who didn't have a sandwich. He had what he always had, a chopped-up hot dog with a scrambled egg and some melted cheese, wrapped up in a tortilla, like a burrito. "Hot dogs belong in buns," said a kid, watching him take a bite. "Not tortillas. Everyone knows that." Ray shook his head. He said, his mouth full of burrito. But when his abuela picked him up, he said, "No more burritos. I just want a sandwich from now on." By Friday, there were only sandwiches. On Monday, there were only sandwiches. But on Tuesday, Minna declared, "I'm sick of sandwiches." So when she unpacked her lunchbox on Wednesday, it was full of gimbap and kimchi and spicy cucumbers and boiled bean sprouts and stir-fried ferns and dried squid in a spicy sauce called gongjang. "You know what? Gim is seaweed, and I love it," she said. "I used to make gimbap with my umma at home." Well, the next day, Ray's burrito was back. In fact, he brought two. My abuela says egg and hot dog burritos make you strong, says Ray, before taking a big bite. He digs pools all day, and he's the strongest grandfather in the world. The next day, Preddy's Doka with Vagar had reappeared. There are more spices in my lunch than colors in the rainbow, they said. Then they named as many as they could remember. Cumin, ginger, onion, chili, mustard, coriander, cloves, and, they thought for a second, asafoetida. That one's my favorite. Well, the same day, Nikki unpacked an everything bagel with lox and cream cheese and a side of pickled herring. It reminded her of Saturday mornings at her family store when the line stretched out the door and everyone wanted a bagel with the works. That's lox, cream cheese, tomato, capers, and sometimes onions. Well, the kid next to her was quiet, staring glumly at his lunch. What do you have? Asked Nikki. Just a boring sandwich, said the kid. Maybe it's not boring, said Nikki. Maybe it's a classic. The kid smiled. Maybe it is, he said. And they ate their lunches together. Okay, I'm going to finish the first half hour of today's program with a picture book titled The First Day of Peace. For many years, the good and loving mountain people collected water from the river that flowed down from snow caps melting in the heat. Families used the water for drinking, washing clothes, and giving life to grapevines they planted along the rocky slopes. Below the mountains, the good and loving valley people took their water from a crystal blue lake. With it, they nourished fruit trees, vegetable gardens, and the fields of corn and flowers surrounding their village. But one summer, the sun shone so brightly that it scorched the earth. When autumn came, no rain fell. Thirsty valley people brought their buckets, but now the lake was just a sad mosaic of cracked brown mud. The ducks flew away, and children climbed on rusty red fishing boats stuck in the silt. Up on the mountain, the people held their pails to the river, but there was no water to be had. Rice terraces turned yellow and brown. Grapes on vines shriveled into raisins. Even the sunflowers drooped toward the ground. One day, a group of valley people walked up the mountain, hoping to collect some river water. The mountain people made angry faces at the valley people and shouted, "Go away!" Next, thirsty mountain people walked down into the valley, carrying buckets to scoop the lake water. Some frightened valley men tossed pebbles at the mountain people to scare them off. "This is our land, and any water is ours," the valley men cried. That winter, snow fell, and ice formed here and there. When spring came, water began trickling down from the melting mountain snow caps once again, and the pitter-patter of raindrops could be heard on tin roofs in the valley. Soon, the river roared, and the lake became blue and liquid once more. There was plenty of water for everyone. That year, and for several years after, the mountain people stayed on the mountain, and the valley people stayed in the valley just as before. The mountain people ate only rice because the valley people wouldn't share their corn. The valley people ate only corn because the mountain people wouldn't share their rice. One afternoon, a mountain boy chased his dog down into the valley, trying to catch him and bring him home. Some valley men saw the boy and screamed, "Go back up to the mountain. Never come back. And tell your friends We want to see them at the ridge tonight. It's time for us to settle things between us once and for all. That evening, when the moon was full and starry constellations filled the sky, mountain and valley folk met along a rocky ridge to bicker and argue, to wrestle and fist fight. But nothing changed. Then came the hottest year, with the stormiest weather that any of the mountain or valley people could ever remember. After a shocking week of gusty winds and torrential summer downpours, a pale sun rose to shine upon the valley's flooded and mud-covered streets. Trees were uprooted, cars floated in the road like bath toys. The flood water was deep and dangerous. It created a rushing river in the street, and families in the valley were trapped inside their homes. But up on the mountain, where the land was safe and dry, children and their pets were free to play outside. Standing on an ancient granite bluff and gesturing at the valley below, a wise and brave mountain girl said, "We need to help." Her heart was full of caring and concern. From house to house, her idea spread. Love catches on. Soon, mountain families came to the valley with soft rice and sweet grape juice to offer, buckets and shovels to clear the mud, and seeds to plant. The valley people felt so grateful that they gave the kind mountain people necklaces made of dried poppies and lavender harvested from the meadows in years past. As the sun rose higher, people who used to frown at one another instead offered smiles. People who used to raise their fist and throw stones instead shook hands and sometimes even hugged. People shared and helped and played in the streets. A new feeling of friendship spread. It was a day of peace. That night, the valley people invited the mountain people to join them in campfire songs of love and freedom. They sang about living without fear and loving without condition. Peace could come, and it could last, because parents and teachers and healers and preachers would do what it took to make it that way. And peace changed everything. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now for about 6 weeks, titled Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging, Confessions of Georgia Nicholson. I am a facsimile of a sham of a fax of a person. Georgia Nicholson's life is far from simple. Her cat, Angus, is the size of a small Labrador. Her 3-year-old sister may have peed somewhere in her room, and her best friend, Jazz, thinks she looks like an alien just because she accidentally shaved off her eyebrows. Enter the sex god. This just might turn out to be the most fabbity-fab year ever. Okay, last week, Georgia has agreed to go to the Stiff Dylan's gig with Mark. He's the guy who put his hand on Elizabeth's breast. Elizabeth's dad said he's going to New Zealand for a month to work and possibly move the whole family there. Elizabeth's now getting ready to go to the concert. And that's where I left off last week. 1 p.m. Rosie has asked the foreign exchange guest student who is staying next door to come to the Stiff Dylan's. I said, "Are you sure that's a good idea?" And she said, "He's called Sven." And I said, "Well, that's what I mean." Rosie says he's a laugh, whatever that means. She said, "He doesn't speak any English, but he is very tall." When I ask where he was from, she said, "I don't know. Denmark, I think. He's blonde." Apparently, she asked him to go to the Stiff Dillons by pointing at him, pointing at herself, and doing a bit of a dance. She's bonkers. We arranged to go to Boots because we needed to have perfume for tonight, and we can use the samples while we pretend we might buy them. 4:30 p.m. Back home, covered in Paloma. I hope it wears off a bit as it's making my eyes water. Also, I've got some new lip gloss, which is supposed to plump up your lips. I'm not sure that this is such a good idea, in my case, especially going with Mark. I wonder if the same rule applies to lips as does to breasts. I mean, if you use them more, I wonder if they get bigger. 5 p.m. If using your lips does make your lips bigger, what on earth has Mark been up to? Am I going to let him kiss me? What does the hand on the breast mean? Do I want him to be my boyfriend? I don't think he's very bright, but he might turn out to be a brilliant footballer, and then I could marry him and be kept in luxury. 5:10 p.m. But then I'd be in all the papers. I'd have to have my nose done. I would have to be careful not to smile. What if I forgot? What if I got caught by the paparazzi smiling and my nose spreading all over my face? In the Daily Express? 5:15 p.m. I can't marry him. Oh, the pressure is just too much. I am losing my own self-esteem while he gets all the attention. I'll have to explain to him tonight that it is all over. 6 p.m. I feel a bit sick. I've got a bit of hair that will not go right. In a minute, I'm going to cut it off. Also, I think I have got knobbly knees. Maybe when I'm Mark's wife, I could have fat injected into them. Possibly taken from my nose, so it would be a two-in-one operation. Smaller nose and fatter knees, all in one swift plunge of the huge hypodermic fat extractor needle. I really do feel sick. 7:30 p.m. I wish I had gone with Jazz and Rosie, all in a big gang. Now it means I'll have to walk in with Mark and everyone will look at me and think he's my boyfriend. Midnight. I cannot believe my life. Well, if you could call it a life. When I think about tonight, I feel like staying in bed for the rest of it. Well, Mark was at the clock tower smoking a fag. He looked sort of okay. When I got near him, he grabbed me and gave me a kiss right on the mouth. No messing about. I was surprised and also a bit worried. Maybe the hand would sneak up to the breast for a bit of a rest. But no, Mark doesn't seem to say much. After the kiss, he took my hand and we started walking to the gig. It was a bit awkward because I'm actually bigger than him, so I had to sort of let my shoulder down on one side like Quasimodo. Well, as soon as we got there, Mark went to say hello to a few of his mates. Rosie's Sven was giant, about 8 foot tall, with a crew cut. Jazz was all moony and looked a bit pale. She said, I wanted that anorexic model look, like I've been up partying all night. I want Tom to think I've not been thinking about him. Well, the gig was packed, mostly boys on one side and girls on the other. Jazz said, aren't you going to talk to your boyfriend? Which is when Tom and Robbie walked in. They saw us and Robbie caught my eye and he smiled. I'd forgotten what a sex god he is. He's all muscly and dark and oh. I smiled back a proper smile because I'd forgotten about my nose for the moment. Then, from behind me, came Lindsay and crossed over to Robbie. He had been smiling at her. My face was so red, you could fry an egg on it. Robbie kissed Lindsay on the cheek. She had her hair up and was quite literally all ears. Yoko! Robbie went up on stage and Tom was left by himself as wet Lindsay chatted to some of her stupid sixth-form mates. Jazz said, "Do you think I should go over and say something to him?" I said, "Have some pride, Jazz. He chose vegetables over you." At that moment, a dark-haired girl came out of the loo and went over to Tom. She put her hand on his arm, and they went off together. And it got worse. The stiff Dylan started playing, and Mark came across to me, got hold of my hand, and pulled me onto the dance floor. His Mick Jagger impersonation did not stop at the lips. He was a lunatic on the dance floor, strutting around with his hands on his hips. I nearly died. Then Sven joined in, dragging Rosie with him. His style of dancing was more Cossack, a lot of going down into a squat position and kicking his legs out. Then he lifted Rosie up above his head. He was whirling her around, going, "Oh, ja, oh, ja." And Rosie was trying to keep people from seeing upper skirt. And that is when I lost it. It was just too funny. Jazz, Ellen, and Jules and I were laughing like hyenas. I had a coughing fit and had to rush to the loo to try to recover. I just calmed myself down and then poked my head around the door to see Sven dancing around, and it started me off again. Then Mark wanted to slow dance. I knew because he grabbed me and pulled me up against him. He was all lumpy, if you know what I mean, and had his mouth against my neck. It was even more difficult dancing with him than it was holding hands. I had to sort of bend my knees and sag a bit in order to fit in. At one stage, I found myself looking straight at Robbie. He looked so cool. Oh, bloody sacre bleu. Even though I hate him and he is a pompous prat boy, I think I may love him. Then the band stopped playing for a break, but Mark yelled, "Play more!" Some of his mates started joining in. Then they sort of rushed the stage and Mark grabbed the microphone from Robbie. He was singing. I think it may have been Jumpin' Jack Flash. Robbie put his hand on his shoulder, and then a massive fight broke out. All Mark's thick friends got stuck into the band, and then the band mates got stuck into them. All us girls were screaming. Sven lifted two boys up at once and tossed them outside into the street. And that's when Ellen, Jazz, Jules, and I decided to do a runner. So, a gorgeous night. I am tucked up in bed. My boyfriend is a hooligan. Before him, I had another boyfriend called Welk Boy. The boy I like hates me and prefers a wet weed with sticky out ears. P.S. My so-called pet spat at me when I walked in all upset. P.P.S. I have found my sister's secret used nappy at the bottom of my bed. Sunday, December 13th, 5 p.m. No sign of Mark, thank goodness. I stayed in, reading all day. Mom and Dad are having a night out. They suddenly want to do things together. It's so unnatural. So I have to babysit Libby. I don't mind, as I never want to go out again. 6 p.m. Libby cheered me up by pretending to be Angus. She curled up in his basket and hid behind the curtains, growling. I had to stop her when she started eating his dinner. 6:15 p.m. Jazz on the phone. I'll never get a boyfriend. I may become a vet. 6:20 p.m. Jazz phoned again. Do you think I'm really ugly? 6:30 p.m. Rosie phoned. I managed to get Sven home before the police arrived. He has given me a bit of holly. I said, why? And she said, I don't know. Maybe it's a Danish tradition. 7:15 p.m., Jules phoned. Someone said they noticed that Lindsay wears an engagement ring when she's at school. 8 p.m., perfect. The doorbell rang, but I made Libby be really quiet and pretend we weren't in. No note or anything. Fed up, depressed, hungry. 9 p.m., fed up, depressed, feel sick. Had 2 Mars bars, toast, milky coffee, Rabina, Coke, toast, cornflakes, and Pop-Tarts. 10 p.m., going to bed. Hope I never wake up. Monday, December 14th, 8:30 a.m. Nearly bumped into Mark on the way to school. Got round the corner just in time. Thank goodness. 9:45 a.m. Slim was livid about the stiff Dylan's gig. She was trembling like a loon. I sincerely hope none of my girls were in any way associated with the hooligans, who behaved like animals at the dance. Rosie looked up at me and put her teeth in front of her bottom lip like a hamster. I don't know why, but it really made me laugh so much I thought I would choke. I had to pretend to have a coughing fit and get my hanky out. Jazz wasn't in school. I wonder where she is. Maybe she has the painters in, if you know what I mean. Rosie was full of Sven this and Sven that. I said, is he your boyfriend then? And she went a bit red and said, look, I don't think we're going out or anything. He's only given me a bit of holly. But as I said that, could mean anything in Denmark. Oh, bloody hell, Jackie and Allison, the bummer twins, are back with a vengeance. They sent a note round saying they want us all to meet by the canteen on Thursday, lunch for, as they call it, the latest. 4:30 p.m., note from Mark when I got in from school. Georgia, I looked for you after the other night. Meet me at 10 at the phone box tonight, Mark. 9:50 p.m. If I don't go, I'll only see him in the street anyway. I shouted to M&D, spending time together again. I'm just taking Angus out for a walk. Dad yelled, don't let him near that poodle. I had to drag Angus away from next doors. He wants to eat that poodle. He has about 4 cans of pet food a day as it is. If he gets any bigger, Mom says she is going to give him to a zoo, as if they would want him. 10 o'clock p.m., Mark smoking by the phone box. He didn't see me coming, hardly surprising as Angus had dragged me behind a hedge chasing a cat. In the end, I tied him to the gatepost. From behind the hedge, I could see Mark. And you know, when you have one of these moments when you know what you have to do? No, well, neither do I. But I did think I must come clean with Mark. It's not fair to him. I decided to say, look, Mark, I like you, and you mustn't think it's you. It's me, really. I just think I could never make you happy. We're so different. I think it's best that we stop right here and now before anyone gets hurt. So I went up to him. He was half in the shadows, and he threw his cigarette down when he saw me. I opened my mouth to speak, and he just kissed me right on the open mouth. What if I had been sucking a Polo Mint? I could have choked to death. Also, he put his tongue in my mouth, which was a bit of a surprise. But then he did it again, and he put his hand on my breast. What was I supposed to do? I hadn't gone to breast classes. My arms were short, were sort of hanging by my sides like an orangutan's when I remembered what Welk Boy had said about putting your hands on someone's waist. So I did that. He had one hand on my breast and one on my bottom. But just when I was thinking, what next, in the hand department, he stopped kissing me. Was this a good moment to say he was dumped? He said, "Look, Georgia, this is not personal or anything, but I think you're too young for me. I'm going back out with Ella because she lets me do things to her. Sorry, see you later." Midnight. See you later? Mark has had the cheek to dump me just as I was about to dump him? I'm never getting up again. Ella lets him do things to her? What things? Two hands on her breast? Tuesday, December 15th, 8:10 a.m. I told Mom I was not going to school or, in fact, getting out of bed. She said, "Why not?" And against my better judgment, I told her, "I've been dumped by someone I didn't even like. I was going to dump him, but I didn't even get the chance." She sat on my bed. "That is bad. It's never nice to be dumped. But look at it this way. You are in exactly the place you wanted to be. You're single and free again. And you have 10 pounds to spend." I grumbled on, "Yeah, well, you would say that. You don't know how sensitive I am and how I really get hurt. And it really takes me ages to get over things. And what did you say about the tenor?" Mad Auntie Calf had come up trumps with a belated birthday present. Hooray! 3:30 p.m. I didn't even bother to put makeup on today. It doesn't matter. I'm not trying to impress boys anymore. No more see you later for me. I'm just going to take my time to grow up and concentrate on my work so I can get a good job and so on. 4:18 p.m. Hell's bells. Robbie was at the gate, probably waiting for his fiancée. I walked by, sort of pretending I hadn't even noticed he was there. But he spoke to me. "Nice company you keep." I had to stop then. I was livid. I wanted to say something really clever and cutting and witty. Something that would let him know I was someone to be careful with. So I said, "I think you are mistaking me for someone who is interested in what you have to say." And I walked on. 8:30 p.m. Yes, Hall. Three times ha and a yes. Double ha with a hyphen. 10 p.m. Vaddy showed me a map of where he is going. Apparently, the area has the most violent geothermal activity in the world. Earthquakes and volcanoes and lava shooting out of the earth and geysers and hot water rivers. It makes you question his sanity. Not for the first time. My Vaddy is not even the outdoors type here. He gets exhausted getting out of his chair or grooming his mustache. It will all end in tears. His. Muddy is draping herself all over him. It is grotesque. The next thing you know, I'll have another little sister or brother. Ugh, I don't even want to think about it. Wednesday, December 16th, 1:30 p.m. Jazz still not back. I'll visit her after school. 4:15 p.m. No reply at Jazz's house. 6:30 p.m. Phone Jazz. Her mom said she couldn't get to the phone as she is not very well. I said, "Is it the flu?" And her mom said, "Well, I don't know, but she's not eating." Not eating? Jazz? Jazz not eating? Oh, things are bad. I said, "What? Not even Pop-Tarts?" And her mom said, "No. Things are much worse than I thought." Thursday, December 17th. 10 a.m. Still no Jazz. This is getting ridiculous. 1:30 p.m. Jackie and Allison's latest thing turns out to be so bonkers, it is not even in the bonkers universe. We all had to go out into the freezing cold at the back of the tennis courts. I was surprised that Jackie knew where they were. I don't think she's ever been near the sports arena before. Then Jackie told us what it was all about. Okay, this is what you do. You crouch down like this, then you start panting really hard, and then you stand up and start running forward. I said, why? And she looked at me and lit a fag. Tardy or what? She had a huge spot on her chin. It looked like a second nose. I'm not surprised her skin is so bad. It's probably been covered in makeup since she was 5. She blew the smoke in my face and said, when you run forward, it makes you faint. Even Rosie, who usually doesn't say much to Jackie, had to repeat this. You faint? Jackie drew on her fag like she was dealing with the very, very stupid. She didn't say anything, so eventually Rosie said, then what? Jackie totally lost it. Then, look, Four Eyes. Think about how useful it can be to just faint when you want to. In assembly, faint, get taken out. In physics, when you haven't done your homework, faint, get taken out. Games, anything. Rosie is nothing if not stupid, so she kept going on. Don't you think someone might notice if we crouched down in assembly or physics and started panting and then ran forward? Jackie walked over to Rosie, and she is quite a big girl. Her breasts are sturdy looking, and she's got big arms. 11 p.m. I still feel a bit odd. I'm not going to be doing anything that Jackie and Allison say ever again. That is it. This stupid fainting thing is it. That is it. I did the panting and then stood up and started running. And I did feel very faint, but not as faint as when I ran into Mr. Atwood coming out of his hut. I may have broken my shin. Sadly, Elvis was okay. And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.